Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama is calling for congressional approval of the international accord to restrain Iran's nuclear program, describing it as the most consequential foreign policy debate since the country's ill-fated 2002 decision to invade Iraq. President Obama is speaking at this moment at the American University in Washington. The U.S. Congress is in the midst of a 60-day window to consider the pact, set to vote in September, whether to accept or reject the deal. Mr. Obama has promised to veto a rejection. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is again expressing concerns over China's massive island-building efforts in the South China Sea. Kerry met with China's foreign minister on the sidelines of the 10-nation ASEAN Forum on Wednesday.
The United States shares the frequently expressed desire of ASEAN members to preserve the peace and stability of the South China Sea. We want to ensure the security of critical sea lanes and fishing grounds, and we want to see that disputes in the area are managed peacefully and on the basis of international law.
Meanwhile, Beijing has rejected criticism of its efforts and have refused to engage in discussions at regional gatherings like the ASEAN meetings. Later Wednesday, Kerry is to meet with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Hundreds of migrants attempting the journey across the Mediterranean are feared to have drowned after their overcrowded fishing boat capsized off Libya, according to Italy's Coast Guard Wednesday. The latest news reports say 400 people have been saved and 25 bodies recovered. The boat had run into difficulty about 15 nautical miles off Libya and sent a distress call. The two vessels were immediately dispatched to the scene. VOA News. South Sudan's army Wednesday dismissed as propaganda rebel claims of a food blockade aimed at starving them into submission ahead of peace talks to end the 19-month civil war. The United Nations and humanitarian agencies have also said some aid is being restricted, including into areas already on the brink of famine. However, an army spokesman denied that it had blockaded boats traveling on the Nile River, which is the main route for aid, into largely roadless northern areas. Saudi Arabia on Wednesday put to death two Ethiopians, a Pakistani and a Saudi, adding to what a rights group has called a campaign of death. The executions bring to 114 the number this year as compared to 87 for all of 2014, according to the AFP. The Ethiopians had been convicted of beating a fellow countryman to death and robbing him, according to the Interior Ministry in a statement carried by the Saudi press agency. In a separate case, the Pakistani was found guilty of smuggling heroin inside his body and was executed in Jeddah. The fourth man, a Saudi, was executed in Jazan after his conviction for shooting dead another Saudi in a dispute. The United Nations revealed Wednesday the Afghan conflict has caused almost 5,000 civilian casualties, including up to 1,600 deaths in the first half of this year. Meanwhile, the Taliban rejected the report. Ayaz Ghul reports.
In its mid-year report released in Kabul, the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan noted that some 90% of civilian casualties resulted from intensification of ground engagements between Afghan security forces and insurgents. UNAMA Chief Nicholas Hesam says that the anti-government forces were responsible for close to 70% of all the civilian casualties, primarily through the use of improvised explosive devices and through the targeted killings of civilians and attacks on civilian locations.
Of the nearly 5,000 civilian casualties, there has been an increase in the number of women and children as a percentage of civilian casualties.
Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
U.S. drones and aircraft have begun arriving at an airbase in southern Turkey, according to the country's foreign minister Wednesday. It comes ahead of a launch of a planned effort to clear Islamic State militants from an area of Syria across the Turkish border. Mevlut Cavusoglu spoke during a visit to Malaysia, where he met on the sidelines of a regional summit with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Investigators should know by the end of the week whether an airplane part that washed up on the Indian Ocean belonged to the missing Malaysian Airlines passenger jet, according to Australian officials. You can read details on that and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, it's very significant because it's actually a lot of people who have died in just 7 months, more than last year. In the same period, the migrants who perished at sea were 1,600, so 400 less than this year. But it is also true that the majority of migrants who died this year actually died in the first 4 months of the year, from January to April 2015, because in the last 3 months, 200 migrants died.
That's Flavio Di Giacomo, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration, commenting on the number of deaths from migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea, which has reached a milestone. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, the daughter of the prominent Burundi human rights activist who was shot by an armed gang says her father is out of danger. And President Muhammadu Buhari has appointed a new head of Nigeria's oil company. We'll have these stories plus sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in for Sunny Young, music from Angola, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the death toll from the number of migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe has reached a milestone this week. Over 2,000 people have lost their lives so far this year. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, confirms this figure surpasses last year's figure for the same period, where 1,600 lives were lost at sea and a total of 3,279 for the year of 2014. Statistics from IOM show that the most dangerous route is the Channel of Sicily on the Central Mediterranean Sea route that connects Libya and Italy. Flavio Di Giacomo is a spokesperson for the IOM in Rome. He provided insight into the deadliest year so far for migrants as they continue to seek a better life in Europe.
Well, it's very significant because it's actually a lot of people who have died in just 7 months, more than last year. In the same period, the migrants who perished at sea were 1,600, so 400 less than this year. But it is also true that the majority of migrants who died this year actually died in the first 4 months of the year, from January to April 2015, because in the last 3 months, 200 migrants died. And the reason for this fact is that starting from May and June, the European Union started a search and rescue operation at sea. She's called Triton. Actually, this operation was already in place, but starting from May was strengthened and improved in terms of numbers of ships at sea and in terms of geographical limitation of the operation, which now patrols all international waters very close to the Libyan waters, where actually the boats of the migrants are in distress and they need to be rescued. So this new European operation actually changed this trend, fortunately, and less people are dying because there are more people which have been rescued on time.
Where have most of the migrants been coming from in the past 4 months, the earlier and heavier parts of the year?
Actually, there are two main routes now of migrants arriving to Europe. There are the migrants arriving to Italy, and the country of transit is Libya. We're talking of migrants coming mainly from West African countries, from Nigeria, Mali, Gambia, but also from Sudan, from Eritrea, Somalia, Ethiopia as well. And Libya is the country of transit, and they leave from Libya in order to get to Italy. So far, 98,000 migrants arrived from this route. There is another route, which is quite new for this year. It was the first time that we have seen so many people arriving. And it is the route which arrives in Greece from Turkey. And these migrants are essentially Syrians and Afghans. And 90,000 migrants arrived in Greece this year, which is an impressive number. But the majority of people died in the Channel of Sicily. More than 1,100 people died in the Channel of Sicily, while about 60 migrants died on a Greek route. It means that the Channel of Sicily is the deadliest route for migrants, for many reasons, of course, because the route is longer. The Channel of Sicily is very difficult for a boat to be crossed, because the migrants, unfortunately, in Libya are in the hands of unscrupulous traffickers and smugglers who provided them with unworthy vessels that after a few hours of navigation have problems, and then they can die in shipwrecks And sometimes they even die when they're on the boat, because, for example, last week there were about 20 migrants who died on board on these vessels because they were in a hold of this boat. And they died because of the heat. They ran out of water and they died of thirst, which is unacceptable in the 21st century.
Yes, and also you mentioned that the Triton operation has really stepped up and strengthened its forces. So are they out there on a daily basis rescuing people?
There are rescue operations every single day. I would say that about 24,000 migrants can be rescued in July, more or less the same number in June. So every day we see that there are rescue operations. We have staff in Sicily and in southern Italy, and every single day there are these boats of the Triton operation, multinational ships. I mean, there are ships which have been provided by many European member states who carry out this rescue operation, and every day they arrive in Sicily with many migrants on board, the consequence of many rescue operations which are carried out in international water.
Also, you anticipate that there will be many more migrants trying to reach Italy or other European countries before the end of the summer, and you're looking at maybe over 200,000?
It's a number that will be reached very soon, because we have already registered the arrival of 190,000 migrants. So it's very difficult to imagine how many people would have arrived by the end of the year, but at the same time, we must consider those people, they are arriving in the European Union, which is an area with 500 million people, especially if we make a comparison with what is happening in other areas not far from the European border, such as in Turkey, where 2 million Syrian refugees, or in Lebanon, where 1.2 million Syrian refugees, or in many African countries where there are big movement of people. So what is happening in Europe, actually, is just a small consequence of this big movement of people, which we have seen in many parts of the Middle East or Northern Africa.
That was Flavio Di Giacomo, a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration, IOM. He spoke with me from Rome. Well, today, yet another Mediterranean tragedy involving migrants. Doctors Without Borders reports that a large, overcrowded boat capsized today in the Mediterranean. The International Office for Migration says Italian and Irish naval vessels have rescued about 100 survivors so far, but hundreds more may have drowned. The Italian Coast Guard reports that the vessel overturned, pitching many passengers overboard. Sky News 24 TV reports an estimated 700 migrants were on board. The daughter of the prominent Burundi human rights activist who was shot by an armed gang on Monday says her father is out of danger. Zaijin Imbonimpa told AP that Pierre Claver Imbonimpa is conscious and being monitored in a hospital in Bujumbura. The vocal opponent of President Pierre Nkurunziza was attacked while walking home. The assassins encircled him as they rode motorbikes and shot him in the face and neck. No one has been charged in the incident. Human Rights Watch says Imbonimpa is a respected voice for human rights in Burundi. It has appealed to the government to ensure his safety. The assassination attempt occurred a day after Mr. Nkurunziza's former security chief and several uninformed or uniformed bodyguards were killed in a missile attack. Mr. Nkurunziza responded with an appeal to both sides to avoid vengeance in the five-month conflict. Street violence and a mass exodus of civilians to Tanzanian refugee camps began after Mr. Nkurunziza announced plans to run for what some claim is an unconstitutional third term in office. His re-election on July 21st was opposed by many regional and Western diplomats. Amnesty International has released a new report describing what it calls 4 years of unrelenting attacks against civilians in Sudan's South Kordofan state. The civilian casualties result from 4 years of conflict between the Khartoum government and the Sudan People's Liberation Army North. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The report, called Don't We Matter, says many of the attacks targeted civilian areas without warning and without legitimate military targets. It says people living in rebel-controlled areas have endured an unrelenting campaign of aerial and ground attacks by the Sudan Armed Forces, and that during the last 4 years, there have been military offensives by one or both parties to the conflict, which have increased the dangers faced by civilians. Yagoua Toot is Amnesty International's country campaigner for Sudan and South Sudan. She says one characteristic of the conflict, especially in areas controlled by the SPLA North, has been the use of ground shelling and aerial bombardments against civilians.
Between January and April, 374 bombs fell in civilian populated areas of South Kordofan. This has injured about 70 people and also killed 30 people. But other than what has happened between January and April, hundreds of people have died as a result of this conflict. Thousands others have been injured as a result of this conflict as well.
In April 2014, Sudan launched a military offensive called Decisive Summer.
A characteristic of Decisive Summer has been attacks against civilian areas, not only on SPLA North positions, but in civilian areas and where civilians are living. People say that if they are bombing hospitals, then there is nowhere else the Sudanese air forces are not going to attack.
Amnesty accuses Sudan of violating international humanitarian and human rights laws. Toot says Khartoum has blocked humanitarian access to rebel-held areas.
So for instance, last year, between May 2014 and January 2015, there was a measles outbreak in the region. Children in SPLA North-controlled areas did not have access to much-needed vaccines. They were being distributed by UNICEF and WHO in other parts of Sudan.
She says Amnesty has had difficulty confirming allegations of abuse by rebels because the government has denied access to SPLA North-controlled areas. However, other organizations have accused the rebels of violating rights laws in government-held regions. The rebels do not have warplanes. Toot alleges cluster bombs are being dropped by government planes.
We documented that MIG fighter jets and Antonovs are being used to drop cluster munitions. The cluster bomb is several bomblets put into one. They either explode on impact or might not explode on impact. In several areas of South Kordofan, there are bits of these bombs that have not exploded. So children have also been killed. We've documented several children who've been playing with what they call shiny objects, only to end up losing a limb or even dying from this.
Toot says civilians try to protect themselves.
One of the most remarkable things is the resilience and the courage of people living in these areas. All over SPLA North-controlled areas, there have been foxholes that have been dug in the schools, near hospitals, near homes, and this is where civilians tend to hide. In other areas where there are caves and crevices, then civilians go to these areas. Unfortunately, even these foxholes and caves are not safe sometimes.
She says the resilience of civilians in South Kordofan should inspire international action to end the conflict and bring those responsible for abuses to justice. Part of that, she says, would be to extend the UN arms embargo in Darfur to South Kordofan and Blue Nile State, which is also part of the conflict. Khartoum has accused rebels of hiding in civilian areas and thus attracting bombing attacks.
In places where the bombs were falling, there were no military targets near these places. There were no SPLA North positions in the civilian areas. So we have not found evidence supporting what the Sudanese government is saying, that these areas are being used by the SPLA North.
Toot says there's no difference between a cluster bomb used in Syria and one used in South Kordofan. The Sudanese government has denied several times it uses the weapons. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and here's a recap of our top stories. The death toll from the number of migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe reached a milestone this week. Over 2,000 people have lost their lives so far. And the daughter of the prominent Burundi human rights activist who was shot by an armed gang on Monday says her father is out of danger. And of course, for more information and news, go to our website at www.voaafrica.com. Well, Cameroon says it has arrested suspected Boko Haram fighters who disguised themselves as refugees to attack a refugee camp on its northern border with Nigeria. The arrests follow an attack on two Cameroonian villages in which at least nine people were killed, dozens of children kidnapped, and houses burned. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's government spokesperson, Issa Chiruma Bakari, says the suspected Boko Haram fighters had explosives hidden in their luggage when they were arrested by the military at the Minawawo refugee camp in northern Cameroon. Issa Chiruma says the military acted on a tip.
At the Minawawo refugee camp, four Boko Haram suspects were arrested and are currently being investigated. An operation of the local gendarmerie led to the seizure of one AK-47 type gun, 17 bullets of 7.56 millimeters, a box shipper, and two motorbikes. It should be noted that this operation, carried out within the framework of the fight against terrorism, have also resulted in the arrest of other criminals, including escaped prisoners.
The camp hosts 44,000 Nigerian refugees fleeing the Boko Haram insurgency that has claimed 20,000 lives and displaced hundreds of thousands in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin. Issa Chiruma also announced that at least half a dozen suspected suicide bombers were arrested in Cameroon in the past 2 weeks. Cameroon has previously reported that terrorists were disguising themselves to attack its territory. In May of last year, 15 Boko Haram fighters disguised as soldiers of Cameroon's elite corps, the Rapid Intervention Battalion, were killed in Kolofata, a Cameroonian town on the border with Nigeria. Last month, three suicide bombers disguised as merchants and beggars detonated bombs that claimed dozens of lives. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Thank you, Moki. Well, President Muhammadu Buhari has appointed a new head of Nigeria's oil company. The new group managing director of the Nigerian National Oil Corporation is Emmanuel Ibe Kachikwu. He previously served as vice chairman and general counsel of ExxonMobil Africa. It is one of Mr. Buhari's first appointments. He had earlier announced cabinet positions would be delayed until September in order to clean house in a government rife with corruption. 3 weeks ago, the president banned an estimated 100 oil tankers from the Gulf of Guinea. He also sacked the chiefs of the Navy and the Nigerian Maritime Administration and Safety Agency, the agencies that would help enforce the ban. Mr. Buhari says he took the action to stamp out industry corruption and rampant piracy of oil tankers in the Gulf. The oil industry has criticized Mr. Buhari for taking the unilateral action. A large force of southern Yemeni resistance fighters backed by Saudi-led coalition armored fighting vehicles has reportedly pushed Houthi rebels and their allies out of three southern provinces, including the strategic Al Anad Air Base. Arab media report that the 3,000 ground troops, including 1,500 from Saudi Arabia and the UAE and 1,500 trained Yemenis, along with battle tanks and infantry fighting vehicles, mark a notable escalation in the Saudi-led coalition's involvement in Yemen. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Amateur videos showed southern militiamen supported by the Saudi-led coalition firing into the air to celebrate the capture of Houta, the capital of the South Yemeni province of Lahaj. Arab media report the coalition and its allies now control three southern provinces. The Houthis Al-Masira TV, however, reported that Saudi-led coalition forces had been pushed out of Marib province farther north. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Yemeni Prime Minister Khalid Baha told Arab media
that forces loyal to his internationally recognized government have already taken control of the southern port city of Aden, along with the strategic Al Anayad air base north of the city, and are moving to capture other areas. He says that the battle has now moved from Aden onto Lahaj province with its important Anayad air base, and his forces are focusing on a strategic triangle from the city of Aden north to Taz and Dala provinces, which hopefully will soon be liberated. The prime minister insisted that his government was hoping that all parties would come to the negotiating table and put down their arms. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen, Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed, met with Yemeni leaders now based in the Saudi capital Riyadh, calling on all militias to apply UN Security Council resolutions and pull their forces out of Yemeni cities. United Arab Emirates-based political analyst Theodore Karasik tells VOA that both Saudi Arabia and the UAE have contributed ground forces to help the internationally recognized government of Abdrabu Mansour Hadi to return from exile to the south of the country.
The end game with this mixed force of Saudis and Emiratis is to carve out a portion of southern Yemen so that the Hadi government can solidify its gains and restore order.
Arab media reported that President Hadi met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in Cairo Wednesday to discuss the current military operations inside his country. Mr. Hadi joined dozens of foreign leaders in Egypt to attend celebrations for the grand opening of the newly enlarged Suez Canal. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The daughter of the prominent Burundi human rights activist who was shot by an armed gang on Monday says her father is out of danger. And the death toll from the number of migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe reached a milestone this week. Over 2,000 people have lost their lives so far. And coming up, we'll have music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, Uganda works to reduce poverty in rural areas. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in this week for Sunny Young. And Jonah, I understand a soccer tournament tops your sports report today.
Yes, Kim. The Audi Cup kicked off in Munich, Germany Tuesday. The biennial tournament takes place over 2 days, this year pitting host Bayern Munich against AC Milan and Real Madrid against Tottenham Hotspur in the first round. Madrid made easy work of Tottenham in the first game as Isco floated a beautiful cross onto the head of James Rodriguez in the 35th minute, and the young Colombian did not miss the opportunity to head the ball home and open the scoring. Gareth Bale then doubled the lead in the 78th minute when he tore down the wing, evaded a defender, and ripped a shot from outside the box that was too hard for Tottenham keeper Michael Vorm to keep out. With the 2-0 win, Real Madrid now advances into the final, which will take place later on Wednesday. After the game, Real coach Rafa Benitez spoke about his team's drive to win.
Yeah, for us it's important always for Real Madrid to win every trophy. It's a target, so we will try to do it. We will try to do well. It's not easy because the level of the teams, but obviously for us it's a challenge and we will try to do it.
Try they will, but Real will have a formidable opponent if they want to win this tournament. The second game on Tuesday saw Bayern Munich walk over a Milan team that looked overmatched. Juan Bernat opened the scoring for the hosts in the 23rd minute when his close-range shot deflected off of Milan defender Christian Zapata and into the goal. Mario Götze added a second goal in the 73rd minute, and Robert Lewandowski sealed the game 11 minutes later when he fired a powerful volley into the net from the top of the box. Newcomer Arturo Vidal also had a good game for Munich, almost scoring on a free kick at one point. There was some tension in the game after a hard tackle by Milan player Nigel de Jong took out young Bayern midfielder Joshua Kimmich. Guardiola was understandably angry, as Kimmich is one of Bayern's bright young players, and he needed to be removed from a friendly due to injury.
I'm sorry for Kimmich, and I've said the same to Nigel de Jong. Kimmich can't play in the first Bundesliga match, and also not tomorrow. For me, he's going to be one of the best German players over the next 10 years. I'm telling you right at this moment, record what I'm saying. I'm sorry for him.
Why was he angry?
Because he can't play anymore, and just because of a friendly game.
With the 3-0 win, Bayern now move on to meet the aforementioned Real Madrid in the final later on Wednesday. Tottenham and Milan will also play each other in a third-place consolation game on Wednesday. All of these games are just days away from beginning their domestic club seasons. Bayern Munich will begin their Bundesliga campaign on Friday. Tottenham starts the Premier League season on Saturday. Real Madrid will kick off La Liga on August 21st. And Serie A will begin for Milan on August 22nd.
You want to listen to the latest African music? Just tune in to the African Beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
African Beat. We love it.
I feel good.
But right now, you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports with Sonny Young. So check it out.
The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma joins us now from Johannesburg, South Africa, and I believe he starts us off with some swimming news.
South African Cameron van der Berg won his heat in a new men's world 50 meters breaststroke record of 26.62 seconds at the FINA World Championships in Kazan, Russia on Tuesday. His old world record stood at 26.67 seconds. In athletics, Uganda's World Student Games 1500 meter champion Dorcas Ajok was crowned the Nile Special Uganda Sports Press Association USPA Sports Personality of the Month for July in Lugazi, some 50 kilometers east of the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Ajok completed the 1500 meters in 4 minutes and 18.53 seconds to triumph at the World Student Games in Gwangju, South Korea, last month. In basketball, hosts Mali outplayed Equatorial Guinea 89-29 at the Africa Boys Under-16 Basketball Championships in Bamako. Ethiopia edged South Africa 70-67. Egypt beat Nigeria 107-46. Algeria dismissed Rwanda 66-44, and Tunisia outplayed Morocco 61-40. In football, former Malawian international player Ernest Mtwawali is the new head coach of the Malawi national team, the Flames. The Malawi Football Association president Walter Nyimilandu disclosed in Blantyre. Mtwawali takes over from another former Malawian player, Young Chimotsi, who was sacked after Malawi lost 2-1 at home to Zimbabwe at the start of their 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifying campaign in June. Nyimilandu has tasked coach Mtwawali to get the Flames Nations Cup campaign back on track and to spearhead Malawi's progress in the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifiers. Finally, the Chinese capital Beijing will host the 2022 Olympic Winter Games. The International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach disclosed in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. The Chinese capital narrowly beat Almaty in Kazakhstan 44-40 when the matter was put to the vote. Beijing will be the first city to have hosted both the Summer and Winter Olympics, having staged the Summer Olympics in 2008.
Thank you, Mark. And now more on those 2015 World Aquatics Championships that are taking place in the central Russian city of Kazan, and where world records are dropping like flies. On Tuesday, U.S. swimmer Katie Ledecky, who is just 18 years old, broke her own world record in the 1,500-meter freestyle, posting a time of 15 minutes, 27 seconds, and 71 milliseconds. Earlier in the competition, Ledecky won the gold in the 400-meter freestyle with a championship record time of 3 minutes, 59 seconds, and 13 milliseconds. After her amazing feat in the water, Katie spoke about what it's like to break a world record.
I feel great. You know, it's pretty, you know, it's probably one of the coolest world records I've broken, and, you know, each one is really unique, but just sort of how relaxed I was and how calm, and it's just pretty neat, and hopefully I can carry that energy through the rest of the week.
Records were also broken by Sarah Sjolström of Sweden, who beat the previous mark in the 100 meters butterfly, and Katinka Hoshu of Hungary, who smashed the standing record in the 200-meter individual medley. On the men's side, Great Britain's Adam Peaty broke two World Aquatics Championship records, beating the former mark in the 50 and 100-meter breaststroke. China is the current leader in medal count with 11 golds and 25 total. They are followed by host Russia, who have 9 golds and 15 total medals, while the United States is in third place with 6 golds and 13 medals. South Africa is the only African team to medal so far, and they sit in 11th place with 1 gold and 1 silver. The championships will continue in Kazan until August 9th, at which point many swimmers will begin training for the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro next summer. And moving on now to boxing, Floyd Mayweather, considered by many to be the greatest boxer active today, has announced his next fight. He will be fighting Andre Berto, a two-time welter world title holder, who is 30-0 during his career in the ring. The fight will take place on September 12th at the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas, Nevada. This will be Mayweather's first fight since he took on Manny Pacquiao on May 2nd in an event that generated more than $500 million, of which $220 million went to Mayweather. Mayweather won that fight by unanimous decision to raise his career record to an amazing 48 wins, including 26 knockouts and 0 defeats. Berto is not expected to stand a chance against Mayweather, despite being 7 years younger. And he will not be discouraged, though, as Berto said that, quote, "somebody is going to get knocked out, and it won't be me," end quote. If Mayweather can win again, he will tie the great Rocky Marciano's career undefeated record of 49-0, which would truly place Floyd in rarefied air. Mayweather, 48, has announced that this will be the last fight of his illustrious career. And now, quickly before I go, for all of you Premier League football fans out there, a quick reminder that the Premier League season will be kicking off this Saturday, August 8th. Make sure to tune into the 30-minute extended edition of the Sunny Side of Sports this Friday at 17:30 UTC, where I will be previewing the Premier League season. Once again, that will be this Friday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America. And that does it for the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Well, coming up, Uganda works to reduce poverty in rural areas. And in Zimbabwe, some living with albinism say they face public discrimination. But first, some music. Here's Danny L. of Angola with Amatumba.
Ela vem mania aquela gorda aí das vezes. Aquela tua amiga. E a vez ter comigo e disse que te quer. Aí você vai ter problema, não sei como é que vais fazer. Ela tá rija, tá insistir. Surra! Pelo postiço não lhe caiu, não sei pro que insiste. Estilo do bem marado, mas até moça resiste. Boca estilo surra, cara enfeitada tipo elele. Chega na disco gingona, todos fogem da negra bué. Lá vem ela. Desculpa, menina, se ofendo, mas é demais, não tem jeito. Dá-lhe, vai! Lá vem ela, a Matumba. Bunda, venha, bunda, tunda. Corpo é corpo, é imbondeiro, é. Não aguento, não tem jeito. Olha só o espaço que ocupa no carro da outra. Fofuxa. Tipo candongueiro bem cheio na hora da conta. Nem racha um bumbo para abastecer na bomba.
Agarrado mulher
que chega bem rápido para cair na quizamba. Agarra Matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para Matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma Matumba, que era quizumba. Agarra Matumba, agarra Matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para Matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma Matumba, que era quizumba. Agarra Matumba. Rife do Rio de Janeiro, mas mesmo assim não tem jeito. Dente, luta contra dente, que uso é de ferro. Galina, dá licença, tenta chegar no sapato. Pois mudou o penteado, aterrando um afro maravo. Lá vem ela,
a malaica,
candongueira,
a xaxeira.
Se te agarra, parte esqueleto. Desculpa, menina, se ofendo, mas o retrato é verdadeiro.
Ela te quer, o que ela quer? Ela te quer, vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero, vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero, é melhor lhe dar pra te ensinar. Agora ou nunca, é melhor lhe dar pra te ensinar. Agora ou nunca,
não vale a pena, dicas malaicas, de nainita. Se ela não lhe quero, se ela lhe quero, ele não quer.
Tu ama tu.
Não vale a pena vir ofender. Você só se coça com quem quero. Ela te quero, você não quer.
Tumba, Matumba.
Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Comprei no estrangeiro, mas continua Matumba.
Coça,
coça,
é de se coçar,
é.
Ninguém aqui vai se atrapalhar. Daniel chegou para te animar. Mania fez esta batida. Que me cuia. Se não tem troma que é tua. Quem não dançou, manda ele em vida. Quem gostou, vai ficar. Vamos continuar até coçar.
Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Tá doce, tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Tá doce, tá doce.
2005. Os matucos tão tipo salelê na madeira.
Cuidado com este meu quiabo. Você me vê tirar voado. Fica maiado com este som. Bate frita tipo bacon. Nossa batida é muito chique. Tipo GT7 na SIC. Quer se matar?
Se mata.
Remexe a bunda. Sucesso até na sanzala. Na disco, na cama e na sala. Você fala mal, não me cala. Olha mal, mas não me atrapalha. Vida de não é problema. Todo mundo entra no esquema. Vira do lado, vira do outro. Remexe a bunda.
And that was Danny L with Amatumba. While Uganda is working to reduce poverty in rural areas by helping families to improve sharing of responsibilities and plan their workloads, they have implemented a household mentoring program in 13 districts, helping 20,000 families. Esther Gwiti has the story written by the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD.
52-year-old Joseph Tilibita has three wives and 15 children. 5 years ago, he was unable to provide for his large family. The situation was so dire that two of his wives left him. But thanks to the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, that is now in the past. Tilibita is busy tilling his farm, where he now grows bananas, cassava, maize and beans, as well as other food crops. Tilibita and his wife Irene Nagobi are in a training session with their mentor Sarah Ndikuliwange. Since 2010, Sarah has been making regular visits to the family to provide ideas on how they can work better together and develop their lives.
The type of training we do is to promote sharing of activities. Everyone takes responsibility to do all things around the house. Whether it is farming, feeding the children, or taking them to school, everyone is involved.
The project has trained more than 600 mentors, and each one is responsible for 10 families. Part of Sarah's work is to educate families on sanitation, family planning, and better farming techniques. Joseph and his wife Nangobi now work together. They have increased their farming area and have enough food to eat, sell, and even send their children to school.
Before we started working together, even if we had some money, it was not used to cover basic necessities. But now I know how much money we have, and we decide together on what to use it for.
Through household mentoring, over 90% of these families have improved the quality of their lives. IFAD's Uganda Country Program Manager says the mentoring program is working well.
These are really the households that do not make to be reached by other development interventions. And therefore, it has become a very important tool for IFAD to be able to reach out to those poorest households.
Similar to other African communities, Ugandan women are relegated to the back seat when family decisions are made. Their workload is excessive, and often these gender inequalities are part of the reason why many families remain poor. Plans are now being made to replicate the program in other parts of Uganda.
And that was Esther Gitui reporting. Well, in Zimbabwe. In Zimbabwe, some living with albinism say they face public discrimination and receive no support from the government due to their skin condition. VOA correspondent Lorda Moyo has more details.
More than 14,000 Zimbabweans live with albinism, a mutation of several genes which causes a deficit in the production of melanin that is responsible for determining skin and hair color. According to the United Nations, the physical appearance of persons with albinism is often the object of erroneous beliefs and myths influenced by superstition, which foster their marginalization and social exclusion. This leads to various forms of stigma and discrimination. The United Nations says most beliefs and myths associated with albinism are centuries old and present in cultural attitudes and practices around the world. 20-year-old human rights activist Phyllis Muzongi of the Zimbabwe Albinos Association, who lives with albinism, says women with this condition have become targets of rape.
Yeah, people used to believe that if you slept with a person with albinism, you actually cure HIV and AIDS.
In 2013, the United Nations Human Rights Council adopted a resolution calling for the prevention of attacks and discrimination against people with albinism. Despite such moves, Muzongi says people living with albinism do not access education facilities and are normally sidelined at workplaces simply because of their skin color.
They are facing low job opportunities because some other jobs do not cater for them, because sometimes they are being done in the sunlight. We don't need to be exposed on sunlight.
She says there is also a need for the Minister of Education to seriously consider having large prints in books used in schools due to eyesight problems associated with albinism.
Because they will be facing a problem of not actually seeing the things written on the paper because there is no large print.
Human rights activist Andrew Mambondiani, who is also a journalist, says there is need for the government to empower people living with albinism so that they can be self-reliant.
There is need to increase the funds so that they can be friendly to people with albinism, and also in class they should be allowed to sit, especially at the front near the blackboards or where the teacher is writing, so that they'll be able to see what the teacher is writing.
If empowered, Muzongi says albinos will manage to even buy sunscreen, creams, umbrellas, long-sleeved clothes and hats, which protect them from direct sunlight that damages their skin.
There is shortage of sunscreen lotions, which we are facing as people living with albinism. Most of us, we no longer have money to buy those lotions. We face problems of sunburns. If you get burnt, we face some problems of cancer. We need to have some umbrellas as well as some lotions. We also need to have some sunglasses so that it will be easy to read on the board, or even to avoid the light penetrating to our eyes directly.
But traditional healer Alfonso Mabele still believes that people with this condition are cursed. This is a common belief among traditional healers who have been accused in some East African nations and others of using albinos body parts to produce juju or muti for empowering politicians and business people. The United Nations estimates that in Tanzania alone, about 75 albinos have been killed since 2000, and the frequency of attacks on them seem to be increasing. The effectiveness of this is widely regarded as a myth, as there is no scientific evidence to prove such claims.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbunganyi, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
500 of sub-Saharan Africa's most promising young leaders have gathered here in Washington to meet with President Barack Obama and leading U.S. entrepreneurs, government officials, and civil society representatives. The three-day summit, August 3rd, 4th, and 5th, will do more than that, however. It will also underscore our nation's commitment to Africa's people, democracy, and governance, and highlight our commitment to addressing issues that affect us all. increased engagement with the nations of Africa is a high priority of U.S. foreign policy. President Obama has emphasized how important this relationship is, beginning with his traveling to Ghana soon after taking office in 2009. The presidential summit follows 6 weeks of academic study and leadership training for the 500 fellows at 20 institutions of higher education across the United States as part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship. The event will also feature a town hall with President Obama, a plenary session with members of Congress, and breakout discussions with leaders in business, government, international development, and non-governmental organizations. Forging stronger personal connections among these young leaders advances America's and Africa's many, many shared priorities. It also fosters further future engagement and deepens the partnership between the American and African peoples as we both pursue a better future for us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
I'm on you.